Is race a scientific fact or just an idea that changes depending on the circumstances? Nell Irvin Painter looks at how people have understood race throughout history by examining which groups have been accepted as being white and why in her latest book, The History of White People. Nell Irvin Painter recently retired from Princeton, where she was the Edwards Professor of American History. This book, her seventh, is published by Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today.
Thank you.
The 2010 census form asked residents to identify themselves as belonging to one or more of 16 different races, including the white race. How accurate is it to describe whiteness as a race?
Oh, la, la, what a question.
Well, people are going to have to make that decision.
Yes.
Most people will just automatically check the box.
No. Oh, well, I don't know about most people, but I can tell you that I've been hearing that many people are distressed about having to make decisions, particularly people who know that they are, this is a passive voice, are considered white, but don't want to be complicit or consider their ethnicity more important or for a whole range of reasons. So it's not easy.
Well, people have often been forced to make that decision.
Yes. Yeah.
And choose who they want to be identified with.
They've been forced by law or by custom or by families or by ambition. You know, in our daily lives, we live in so many different contexts that you can be one race in one context and not race in another because you're in your family.
But being white by custom is usually a matter of not being black or Asian.
Yeah, not being something else.
Mm-hmm. Haven't people often been reluctant to identify themselves in terms of race because race is used as a justification for denying opportunities to specific groups of people?
Yes.
So by checking off that box, even if when you show up, anybody can make some kind of determination. Checking up that box automatically will determine certain things.
Yeah, but you're talking about a process that occurs once every 10 years. So people don't live their lives in the census.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more a matter of what you do on a day-to-day basis. And in the 20th century, we actually had to live with laws that were enforced about who could not go where.
Do you think that things have changed partly because we have a biracial president?
Gee, I don't know which is the chicken and which is the egg. It seems to me that things started changing in terms of race in the United States. And when I say race, I mean all the races, about the mid-90s or so.
So W.E.B. Du Bois was off by 10 years when he said the whole 20th century? Because it's my sense that race is still a major issue.
Race is still a major issue, and people love to talk about it, even though they hate it. They love to hate to talk about it. But it's not the same as it was in the 20th century, where one drop of black blood could condemn you to living in a squalid home and not having very good outlooks on life.
But are you willing to go along with those people who say we're living in a post-racial age?
No, that's really easy.
Do ethnicity and race mean the same thing? People often seem more comfortable talking about ethnicity than about race.
Yeah, ethnicity is also often considered a euphemism for race. And certainly it was invented in the 1940s, became popular in the 1970s. And in the 1970s, the people who used it were using it to claim a certain kind of group pride. Since white pride had already been hijacked, you couldn't go around saying, I'm white and I'm proud, unless you were a hijacker. So there were other ways of being proud. I'm proud because I'm Italian. I'm proud because I'm Jewish. I'm proud because I'm Slavic, you know, and so forth. But if you look in the dictionary, both words have many, many meanings, and it's very hard to tell them apart.
Well, I remember, I know a bit about gospel music, and once I was talking to a black gospel singer, a very famous one, who told me that her concerts were often attended by whites and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of surprised by that.
Why? It's great music.
No, but whites and Jews.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought, well, gee, most of those Jewish people would be white, wouldn't they?
It would depend on what generation they were. Old people like us are more likely, Jewish old people like us are more likely to see a difference between whiteness and Jewishness. Their children realize it has to do with context, and their grandchildren are just white people.
I want to ask you about your book's title, which made me smile when I read it. It strikes me as pretty lighthearted for a history that contains 96 pages of notes and a 34-page index.
Yeah.
The history of white people, in a way, it almost sounds like you're thinking about that bestseller, Things That White People Like.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't thinking about what white people like. And I must say, the concept of what white people like is usually just the concept of what middle-class people like, no matter what their background. But the working title was Whiteness in Historical Perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And people would say, what are you working on? And I'd say, Whiteness in Historical Perspective.
Which is more accurate description
and they would
of
say,
the book.
What's that? And I'd say, you know, the history of white people. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, the Human Genome Project revealed in 2003 that humans share 99.9% of their genetic makeup, has been cited often to say that there's really no scientific or biological basis for racial discrimination or even for talking about race.
That's right. And that is not news. The parsing of the human genome in 1999-2000 was just the latest proclamation of science saying, you know, race doesn't make any sense. But people were saying that for years. It was clear for years. It was clear in the 30s. It was clear when the term Caucasian was applied to white people by Jan Friedrich Blumenbach in Germany. He said, you know, varieties, he called them, not races. He said, the varieties shade into one another imperceptibly. And he said, you can take your pick as to how many you want.
Mm-hmm. So has there been a distinction between the way academics and scientists see all of this in the way the rest of the world does?
A lot of academics were quite happy to go on along with race right down into the 50s and 60s. I wouldn't say that the academic world as a whole moved out of the column until probably yesterday.
My guest is Nell Irvin Painter. Her latest book is The History of White People, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopez. Well, eugenics grew out of kind of pseudoscience, but there were legitimate scientists who got involved.
At the time, there were legitimate scientists involved. And, you know, my editor wanted me to put racial science in quotes, science in quotes, because it was spurious science. And I said no, because it was science of the time. And if I go around deciding what is science, I am going to be bogged down in an entirely different book. So I have not put racial science, I have not used quotation marks, but I have presented the credentials of the people who are talking.
And it struck me that so many of the theories you've written about, which seem pretty hard to believe today, came from men connected with Harvard, Yale, Princeton, other prestigious universities.
Yes. Yeah, and it's not that those particular institutions were uniquely bad or mean. It's that those ideas were the reigning ideas. And you can prove that those were the reigning ideas, in a sense, because they reached into the stratosphere of American academia.
And one of the leading figures here was Samuel George Morton.
Yes.
A doctor, highly respected anthropologist at the University of Pennsylvania.
Right.
And he amassed a collection of 918 human skulls before his death in 1851.
Yeah.
Is this the beginning of eugenics?
Ooh, where is the beginning of eugenics? That's a hard question. But usually,
he believed that it was possible to determine a person's intelligence by measuring the skull.
But eugenics is about breeding better people.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say Morton was not involved in that. Morton was measuring skulls. Blumenbach was measuring skulls. A whole bevy of people were measuring skulls.
And what does measuring skulls reveal, ultimately? Do certain groups, whatever we want to call them, have larger skulls than others?
Yes. It turns out that focusing on the head was what people did a lot, particularly in the 19th century. And then we have inherited the whole IQ mania, which is so closely related. But what anthropologists did was look for something that they could measure and then divide. So from the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century, the shape of the skull, brachycephalic or dolichocephalic, this was supposed to be one of the most trustworthy measures of race.
And they discovered that white people were superior to Native Americans, who were superior to African Americans.
Well, this is true in American terms, particularly when you're talking about the South. But what I wanted to stress in my book is that so much of race thinking in the United States has been applied to people we now consider white. So the races of Europe, the dolichocephalics and the brachycephalics, those were white people, and they fell out into three main races: Teutonic, Alpine, and Mediterranean.
So which was, I guess, one of them was more superior than
course,
the next?
The Teutonics.
Mediterraneans were the worst.
Well, yes. Teutonics had long heads and light hair and light eyes, and they were the best. Alpines were in the middle until the Second World War, and they had round heads and kind of brownish. And then Mediterraneans had long heads, and long head was the right shape, but they were dark, so that was not so good. So it was a hierarchy of white races. Always the problem was the Lapps and the Jews. What do you do with these people? And sometimes they were considered part of the races of Europe, and sometimes they were not.
Mm-hmm. But the Mediterraneans would be the Italians, new Italian immigrants,
yeah.
And they were not as welcome as the Scandinavians or the Germans.
That's right.
Or the British.
Yeah.
Wasn't Morton the man who came up with the word Aryan?
No, it was not Morton. Aryan goes back to somebody like Jones, early in the 19th century, a philologist talking about languages. So Aryan first had to do with languages, and then because the 19th century was so fixated on race, became a race.
Isn't Aryan and Iran pretty much the same word?
This I don't know. As I know it, Aryan is Sanskrit for noble people.
Mm. Well, and then Hitler liked that idea.
Hitler liked that idea. The idea became popular because of a man named Gobineau, who was French and wrote in the middle of the 19th century, and then became popular in the 20th century.
Now, it was the skull size just a matter of intelligence? Wasn't there also a moral worthiness in the equation?
Well, racial temperament was always of crucial importance. So your race or your outward appearance was the index of what was inside you. The idea that the bigger skull had the bigger brain and the bigger brain had the smarter people, that was popular in the middle of the 19th century. And a French anthropologist got into trouble because the French people they measured were smaller than the Germans they measured. So then the question is, does that mean that the intelligent French people are dumber than the intelligent German people? So the answer to that was not to talk that much about measuring brains anymore.
Your book starts with a chapter on the Greeks and the Scythians.
Yeah.
Is that when this whole thing began?
No. I started back in antiquity because the idea prevails among some people still that you can trace whiteness in the way we talk about it, sort of white race, back across the millennia into the mists of time. So I needed to deal with that first. And part of the whole point of my book is that this is a history, that things change over time. And so there's an invention of race and an invention of Caucasians.
But there's also the desire to apply science to all of this.
Well, science, again, an invention of the Enlightenment, 18th century. So if we were looking for the truth before the 18th century, we'd probably ask about religion.
You have credited Louis Agassiz, a physician, with shaping the field of American anthropology during the 1800s by developing natural history museums in the
mm-hmm.
United States. And you've
mm-hmm.
described him as a polygenesist.
Yes.
What's a polygenesis?
What is a polygenesis? That means that there's more than one genesis. So there's more than one originary couple. There's more than one Adam and Eve. So for Agassiz and for Morton and for others in the American School of Anthropology, each race had its own Adam and Eve. They were embarrassed by the problem of, if they're also different, how come they can fornicate and have children together? This was a problem for them. In fact, people fornicating and having children has always been a problem.
Well, for the racial scientists. But there are so many different kinds of people. How did they deal with the Inuit, another Adam and Eve up there?
This is why I say it was just crazy because, well, when they say Inuit, they swept them together with Lapps.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, you know, how do you decide? How many races are there? What do you measure? What's good? What's bad? And so it has never been clear.
And so much of this is based simply on skin color. So
not just skin color. Skin color is very helpful if you have people with different colored skins. But if you don't, then you measure their skulls, or you measure what you say is their intelligence, or you measure other things.
And when does this change? With Charles Darwin?
No. Darwin is of crucial importance in the 1859, and Darwin eventually changed the idea.
Because he says we all come from a common ancestor.
Right, right. And
which drove people crazy. They said, well, he said we came from the apes.
So they said.
Yeah.
But in the early 20th century, the racial scientists had their own version of evolution. And they said some races were more evolved than others. So you could be an evolutionist and you could still be a racial scientist.
My guest is Nell Irvin Painter. Her latest book, The History of White People, is published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after this.
Are you an American?
Am I an American? I'm just an Irish, Negro, Jewish, Italian, French and English, Spanish, Russian, Chinese, Polish, Scots, Hungarian, Litvak, Swedish, Finnish, Canadian, Greek and Turk and Czech and double Czech American. And that ain't all. I was baptized Baptist, Methodist, Congregationalist, Lutheran, Atheist, Roman, Catholic, Orthodox, Jewish, Presbyterian, Seventh-day Adventist, Mormon, Quaker, Christian, Scientist, and lots more.
Strong, our country's young, and her greatest songs are still unsung. From her plains and mountains we have sprung to keep the faith with those who went before.
Paul Robeson singing about what it means to be an American. Ironic that he was called un-American more than once in his life. Nell Irvin Painter is my guest. Her latest book, The History of White People, is published by Norton. You've pointed out that Nathaniel Southgate Shaler was one of Theodore Roosevelt's teachers. Didn't Roosevelt later come to believe that race was the driving force of human history?
He did indeed. And in that sense, he was very much a figure of his time.
He was worried about race suicide.
He was worried about race suicide, and he was not talking about black people. He was talking about people then considered the alien races, the immigrants who were coming from Southern and Eastern Europe to take low-paid wages. And what I found over and over again is that the idea of race, since its invention in the 18th century, has been used to stigmatize the people who do the poorly paid work, the unpaid work, the people at the bottom.
So he was concerned about undesirable white people.
Yes.
And words like degenerate were used.
Mm-hmm. Degenerate families, it's a slightly different discourse and a slightly different subject line. So when Roosevelt worried about race suicide, he was worried about immigrants. Mm-hmm. The degenerate families, this was a way of talking about poor white people, largely Southern, not entirely.
Another figure in shaping American thought, somebody we usually think of in a positive way, is Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Oh, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson was the father of... No, he was not the father. He was the orchestrator of Saxonism or Anglo-Saxonism. He didn't invent it, but he put it in such gorgeous terms. He wrote a whole book called English Traits, published in 1856, has a chapter on race. And the point of this book is how wonderful the English are. And the English are wonderful because they're Saxons. And his kind of Americans are wonderful because they, too, are Saxons.
And this is not only a Saxon chauvinism, this is a New England chauvinism.
Well, very much, but he...
White-educated New Englanders are the ideal.
New England part was assumed, the Saxon part was harped upon. And his contrast with elevating the Saxons was to debase the Celts, who were considered a separate and inferior race.
So much of the racism you describe in this book is not the sort that we normally think of, the simple black and white divide. But
virtually all the racism I talk about in the book is...
It's about undesirable immigration and how it changes and threatens the character of the country.
Yes.
Then those groups become integrated into the country.
At a particular time and for particular reasons.
And then nobody's embarrassed about the fact that at an earlier time they took this position?
No, that's not true. Sometimes anthropologists, for instance, took back their words. Carl Brigham, for instance, who actually made a table or a blood table of European nations, how many drops of Teutonic blood, how many drops of Alpine blood, how many drops of Mediterranean blood, and published it, Princeton University Press published it in 1923. And he took it back by 1930.
Those drops are really percentages, right? I mean,
yeah.
I am 10%.
Yeah. No. You are a whatever it is you are. Mm. Say, let's look at the shape of your head. If you have a little round head, you're an Alpine. Mm. 100%, you are 100% Alpine. But how many Alpines like you are in, say, New York City?
Mm-hmm. But if I have that round Alpine head, but my grandfather was from Sweden, how do we work that out?
Well, he couldn't have had a round Alpine head if he was from Sweden.
No, but I mean,
Swedes
I
are 100%.
I can.
Then we have to remeasure you.
You described how the criteria for who's considered white in America has been expanded 3 times. In our country's
mm-hmm.
history.
And when I say criteria, I'm not talking so much about the census. The census changes every 10 years. But in our culture, the American. So we are in the fourth great enlargement of the American. Before that, the American, the idea of a quintessential American is no longer as widely accepted as it was. Now we are a multi-American.
Well, the first one happened mm-hmm. when the government lifted restrictions on voting tied to property
the governments.
Ownership.
So this was states and localities.
Mm-hmm. And then the second is after the mm-hmm. Civil War, and
yes.
that had to have been different in different parts of the country as well.
Well, largely admitting the children of the famine Irish mm-hmm. Into the Nordic column. You see, the columns changed. So in the 19th century, it was Teutonic. And by the 20th century, it became Nordic, which allowed the Irish in.
Now, we discriminated against Asians, the Chinese,
yes.
and limited immigration into
yes.
the 40s, didn't we?
Until 1965.
60s, okay.
Yeah.
It's even
yeah, the
better.
First racially based immigration restrictions were against working class Chinese, 1882, the Chinese Restriction Act.
And that's because they weren't white? Or
it was because,
how did their head shape measure up?
Well, it wasn't a question of head shape at that point. We're talking politics here. And it was those who were active in government were listening to Irish workers, notably in the West, who wanted those jobs.
The third definition of whiteness expanded after World War II?
Yes. And this was a mobilization beginning to, in the 1930s to address the crisis of the Great Depression, accelerating during the Second World War to mobilize and unify the country to fight the war. And then afterwards, in suburbanization and white-restricted housing covenants. So until housing opened up by law, in 1968 with the Fair Housing Act, it was legal to lend money only to white people to move into certain areas, the new suburbs, for instance.
Although only certain white people in some cases.
No, the suburbs were largely everybody white people. the big difference between, say, people growing up in the cities in the 30s and the suburbs in the 50s and 60s was that in the cities, people kind of lived in their own little enclaves, and these could be quite small. But in the suburbs, it was Irish and Jewish and Slavic and Italian all mixed up together.
When did what happened with Hispanics? Because Hispanics can range
Hispanics
in skin
can
color
be of
from,
any race, yeah.
From very light skin to very dark skin.
Right. Officially, Hispanics, asterisk, can be of any race. Some Hispanics declare themselves as being white. Others, large numbers, say that they are other. It may turn out that they will shake out according to black-white. It may well be that the whole taxonomy of race kind of falls apart under the weight of new immigration.
My guest is Nell Irvin Painter. Her latest book, The History of White People, is published by Norton. I was amused years ago during when South Africa was still an apartheid nation. They had real problems when Japanese businessmen came.
Mm-hmm.
What hotels would they allow them into?
Yes.
They decided that Japanese people were white.
Japanese people were white, Chinese people were not, which will tell you how crazy that was.
Well, is it any worse than some of the things we've done over the years?
I was just going to say that in the 1960s, after the wave of independence and from African countries and African diplomats came to the United States, if you were dressed as an African diplomat, you were treated differently from the local black people. Also, if you were, say, a baseball player and you could pass for Cuban, then you could get into the big leagues when the big leagues were still white-lined.
How much of this is a matter of class? Because that's kind of what you've been saying all
class
along, isn't it?
Class is a lot of it. And in fact, class, I think, is going to be even more because we now live in a society that is so stratified by wealth and income. The poor people are going to be virtually all brown and black.
A listener says he travels around the country a lot, and ever since Barack Obama became president, he has seen a lot more people embracing their whiteness, and he wonders how you feel about having the president be Barack Obama. Does that change affect a change in whiteness?
I think it does affect the change in whiteness, if only because it makes many more people aware of not simply being individuals, which is the convention of whiteness. I don't have a race. I'm an individual. As for embracing their whiteness, it depends on how they do it. If they decide they want to become Klansmen, that's not so great in my book. But if they think about themselves in a racial context and they're thinking more, I think that's fine.
Well, now pretty much race means one thing. It's you're either black or you're white in this country.
No, I don't think that's so. Very often, as I've been talking about working on this book, people will come up to me, people who look white will come up with stories of their childhood of being beaten up for being Jewish or beaten up for being Italian. Or it turns out that they consider themselves African American and then they look white. So there are lots of stories. We do live our lives as individuals within families and neighborhoods.
Now, this is something that Americans have thought a lot about over the years because there have been a whole bunch of movies throughout the history of Hollywood in which people could pass and families were split as a result.
Right. Yeah, and you could be condemned to a terrible life if somebody discovered you had one drop of black blood.
Showboat.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you have Pinky, and you have all these other things
yes.
where sometimes where the parent wants the kid to pass.
Yeah.
In other cases, the kid wants to pass and reject the family.
Yeah. And those stories still occur. Those stories still occur for multiracial people or very light-skinned people or people whose cultural identity or family identity doesn't fit with how many of the people in the world look at them. Those stories still exist, but they don't have the overweening live-or-die importance they had in the 20th century.
So do you think that we are finally at a point where we've established what whiteness is, or do you think we're going to go through more changes?
Yes. Yeah. This history has no end. I think that it's going to be less and less important to be white. I mean, in the 20th century, to be white meant you could vote when others who were not considered white couldn't. You could go to certain schools and others could not, and so forth.
Well, we still have that to some degree. I've just been reading about resegregation.
By law. So that's different. We don't have the laws that codify whiteness.
Or prevent people from marrying someone of
that's
a
right.
so-called
1967,
other race.
Just the other day. But the economic side, so that dark skin coupled with poverty, I think, will continue to be racialized.
Now, you've written this book, but I've read that since you retired from teaching, you've gone back to school for yourself.
Yes, I should have my head examined. I did a Bachelor of Fine Arts at Mason Gross School of the Arts at Rutgers. I graduated with honors in 2009, and I'm currently an MFA student in painting at the Rhode Island School of Design.
Just yesterday, we were talking about how often people go into professions that relate to their names. There are a lot of
yes.
dentists named Dennis. Did
really?
You know
yes. No, I didn't know that.
And I mean, when I hear that you're studying painting and your name is Nell Irvin Painter,
yeah.
I can't
That's
help
a little
but wonder
neat,
about whether you almost felt like you were forced.
No. I've had the name for a long time.
Uh-huh. Is this just for fun, or do you...
No, it's too hard to be fun.
Well, there are some people who just paint for the sheer joy of it, and other ones
yes.
who say, if I can't do something of significance, then I don't want to paint.
I'm neither of them.
And but you're still going to be writing histories, I assume.
No.
This is it?
This is it. The next book is called The Truth About Beauty, and I will draw it.
But beauty is also something that often has a racial component,
exactly.
doesn't it?
Exactly. It's a big
different
thing.
People have different
yes.
ideas about what's
yes.
beautiful.
Yes, yes.
And
there'll be some words in it.
But is that what got you thinking about it?
No. The two books were contracted at the same time.
Mm.
And my editor was more interested in the history of white people than the history of beauty.
Mm.
So beauty is on the shelf.
Nell Irvin Painter was the Edwards Professor of American History. You are still emerita?
Yes, and I will be emerita forever.
At Princeton University,
yes.
One of the universities that was so involved with all
yes.
the theories about race. She is the author of 7 books, including Sojourner Truth and Standing at Armageddon. She served as president of the Organization of American Historians and the Southern Historical Association. And she will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at 82nd Street and Broadway. Her latest book, the last book of history, at least according to what she tells me, but who knows what will happen, is The History of White People. It is published by Norton. And I want to thank you so much for being
thank
with us today.
You.
It's been a great pleasure
thank
talking
you.
With you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the conversation, too.